time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Tackling the controversies, engaging the culture, challenging the status quo, and taking your calls. Dr. Brown is the director of Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Call now at 866-34-TRUTH and get into the line of fire.
You know, we often get challenged about having faith and, well, you just believe these things and there's no evidence for it. Well, I've got a friend in the studio with me today who wrote a book that he does not have enough faith to be an atheist. Michael Brown, thanks for joining us today. We're going to devote the entire show to a special interview with my friend, Dr. Frank Turek. So I'm not going to be taking calls, but as always, you can email me at Dr. Brown. That's drbrown at askdrbrown.org. In particular, if you're interested in apologetics, pick up the phone, call a friend, tell them to tune in. And if you've got kids that are in college, this show will really be helpful. And if you're a college-age listener, call a friend, tell them to tune in. Frank, thanks for joining us on The Line of Fire.
Dr. Michael Brown, always a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, my joy. Frank, how did you get involved in the subject of apologetics to start?
Well, I came to faith through apologetics. I actually started reading Josh McDowell books, Evidence Demands a Verdict. This is back in the early 80s, I suppose, mid-80s, and More Than a Carpenter. And so I came to faith through apologetics. And after I was in the Navy for 8 years, I was in the D.C. area, and I was taking a class in apologetics because I was so interested in it at McLean Bible Church. It was just a class for lay people. Dr. Barry Leventhal, whom you and I both know, was the instructor, and he invited a Dr. Norman Geisler to come in and speak in one of these classes that we were having once a week in that church. And Dr. Geisler had just started a church in Charlotte, not a church, a seminary in Charlotte at a big church called Southern Evangelical Seminary, and that seminary was devoted to apologetics. So he invited my wife and I down to look at that back in 1993, and we moved our kids and our whole lives down to Charlotte to attend the seminary.
So when you say you came to faith through apologetics, mm-hmm. how exactly?
Well, I always wanted to know whether Christianity was true. I was brought up in a Roman Catholic home, but I never really knew who Jesus was. It was a lot of rote memory tradition to me, and I didn't know much about Jesus. So when I was in the Navy and then later met a son of a Methodist minister in flight school, he began taking me to other churches. We went to a Methodist church, went to a Baptist church, and I began to learn a little bit about Christianity. And at that point, I got Evidence That Demands a Verdict and More Than a Carpenter and realized that Christianity wasn't just a faith religion in the sense that I'm just taking it on faith, I don't have any reasons to believe this, but that it actually did occur, that Jesus did rise from the dead, that God exists, number one, and number two, Jesus actually rose from the dead, and therefore the scriptures are true.
Now, some of our listeners, you may be in a very sunny part of the United States right now, and you have this sense that you're hearing thunder or that there's heavy rain coming down. Actually, even though we're in a soundproof studio, there's the sound of thunder outside and lightning flashing and rain's coming down. But here it is right now. That reminds me of something, though. Mm-hmm. Isn't it just primitive for us to ascribe certain things to God? The ancients thought, you know, that these were powers of gods, or the sea mm-hmm. was a god, or the sun was a god, and they attributed rain to God or lightning and thunder. We understand now these are just natural phenomena. Isn't it kind of primitive now, just like we don't believe in the ancient Egyptian gods and the ancient Mesopotamian gods? Why believe in the ancient Israelite god?
Yeah, in fact, Richard Dawkins says everyone's an atheist. He said, I just take my atheism to one more god. You don't believe in Zeus, you don't believe in Thor, you don't believe in these other gods. I just rule out one more god. I'm a true atheist. To which we respond, well, yes, Richard, we don't believe in Zeus and Thor either, but the difference is that Zeus and Thor were inside the universe. They were created beings. They were not really God in the sense that they were a spaceless, timeless, immaterial being. And that's what we mean. But when we talk about God, you see, all of nature needs a cause because nature itself was created. At one point, there was no space, matter, or time, and then the entire space-time continuum leapt into existence. So we need something that's outside of space, outside of matter, and outside of time that brought the whole show into existence. And if all space, matter, and time time were created, then the cause must be spaceless, timeless, and immaterial. Zeus and Thor were not spaceless, timeless, and immaterial, but the God of the Bible is.
So even if we have natural explanations for thunder and lightning rain, we still don't have an explanation for where everything ultimately came from.
That's exactly right. You see, some will claim, well, this is a God of the gaps argument, that you're just plugging God in because you don't have an explanation. My point is, when it comes to the beginning of the universe, is that there is no natural explanation for all of nature. That would be in what logic we'd call a category mistake. You can't create yourself because you have to exist prior to creating anything. So you can't have a natural explanation for all of nature because nature itself was created. So it must be something outside of nature that brought it into existence, something spaceless, something timeless, something immaterial. And this is what we talk about in our book, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist.
Now, you debated Christopher Hitchens, famous outspoken atheist, a couple of times. And I know in the second debate, that he basically said something to the effect of, okay, we know the Big Bang happened. Mm-hmm. I don't need to know what happened before that. Mm-hmm. I'm happy not to know. Now, to me, as intellectual a man as Hitchens is, that sounds like kind of sticking your head in the sand. Because
yes.
I have two questions. First, where did the material elements come from if there was a Big Bang? And two, what caused the Big Bang to bang?
Right, that's exactly right. And I pressed Hitchens on that during the Q&A, and I asked, I said, Christopher, all the evidence shows that the universe, space, matter, and time had a beginning out of nothing. What's your atheistic explanation? And after a long joke that went nowhere, and by the way, you can see the debate on our website, crossexamined.org. That's crossexamined with a D on the end of it, .org. You can see both of the Hitchens debates. In the second debate, when I asked him, where did it come from an atheistic perspective, he said, I'm not a physicist. He said, I don't know what to say here. He said, you're not going to convince anybody else in here that it came from a spaceless, timeless, immaterial being anyway. And so if I was given the opportunity to follow up on that question, Michael, the moderator did not give me an opportunity to do that. I would have said, is it just because you're not a physicist, can you then just ignore the evidence from physics? No, you can't do that. I would have said, let's suppose you're a crime scene investigator and you find a dead body with bullet holes in it. And you go up to the dead body and you see that on the body there's a note taped to the body, and the note is in French. Can you pick up that note and go, well, since I don't speak French, I can disregard this note? No, find somebody who speaks French. Christopher, if you don't understand physics, then find somebody who does, but you can't ignore the evidence from physics just because you're not a physicist. Space, matter, and time had a beginning, so it seems like a logical conclusion to me that the cause must be outside of space, matter, and time.
And even if people say that there was a Big Bang, there are Christian theists that believe there is a Big Bang, doesn't that event itself point to some type of divine origin? I mean, the enormity of what happened in a Big Bang.
It has to. That's the point, because the cause is not a natural cause. And what we mean by supernatural, we mean something beyond the natural. That's what super means, beyond the natural. And so there was something outside the universe that brought it into existence. Now, the question that the atheist will come up with is they'll say, well, then who made God? Well, you don't need a cause for an unmade being, because if the cause is timeless, then it didn't have a beginning. If it didn't have a beginning, it doesn't need a beginner. So God is the uncaused first cause. He is the unmoved mover. He's the uncreated creator. So there has to be an uncaused first cause. There's only two possibilities. Either the universe is the uncaused first cause, or something outside the universe is the uncaused first cause. And all the evidence points to the fact that the universe had a beginning. Therefore, there's something outside the universe that is the uncaused first cause.
Now, I want to transition in a moment to talk about what's happening on college campuses, the important ministry, another minute or two, and ask this. There are now scientists who agree that given where the universe is presently and life on Earth, that if the universe is 14-something billion years old, that's not enough time for all of these things to have just developed by random chance. So there must have been and are many, many other universes, and this is just one of those. So it's the multiverse theory. Now, what problem do you have with that?
First of all, the multiverse theory is just a desperate attempt to avoid the obvious implications of design, that there must be a designer out there. There's no evidence for it. It's purely based on faith. And there's a number of other problems with it, which we cover in the book. One of them being is that you need a creator to create all these universes.
Right, you still have the same problem.
You still got the same problem.
Right.
And even Alexander Vilenkin, who with Bord and Guth proved that even if a multiverse exists, that there has to be an absolute beginning for the whole multiverse. So even if there are other universes out there and we're just in the one that appears to be designed, these gentlemen who are not believers have said, look, even the whole show needs a beginning. If that's the case, it needs a beginner.
Yeah, what strikes me as amazing and is in harmony with your book, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, is that people are not willing to say that there was a God because they said we don't have evidence, and yet they're willing to posit that there were maybe an infinite number of other universes, although there's no evidence for it.
That's
and then you still have the same question. Friends, on our website, askdrbrown.org, click on the Line of Fire. We've got a link to Frank's website, crossexamined.org, as well as a link to his book, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. When we come back, I want to talk with Frank about what's happening on college campuses, the massive number of Christian young people who go to secular campuses and lose their faith, and what Frank and his ministry are doing, and some of the key questions that are coming up. Stay with us. Welcome back, friends, to the Line of Fire broadcast. Michael Brown with my special guest, Dr. Frank Turek, one of the top, most clear-headed apologists that I know. I'm not taking calls. You can email me at Dr. Brown, Dr. Brown, at askdrbrown.org. And we've got links to Frank's material at the Line of Fire link on askdrbrown.org. Frank, you are active with your ministry on college campuses, and we've both known that a large percentage, some say 80% or more, of kids who are professing Christians, I don't know their exact state when they go to college, but professing Christians who go to secular universities, maybe 80% lose their faith within the first year. What is it that is so overwhelming to these kids? We know there's the promiscuity, maybe drug and alcohol use, just breaking the rules away from home and all this. But is that the biggest thing that's causing these kids to lose their faith?
Well, it's one of the issues why people lose their faith. George Barna and Lifeway Research both have independent studies on this. It's one of the issues. Intellectually, they don't know why Christianity is true. That sometimes causes them to fall away because when they get to college, Mike, you know as well as I do, they rarely run into Christian professors. In fact, a recent study by two Jewish researchers from 2007 was trying to figure out whether professors were anti-Semitic. You know what they found? Virtually zero anti-Semitism on college campuses. What they found instead was anti-evangelicalism.
Yes.
53% of college professors view evangelical students unfavorably. 53%.
Yep.
Now, one of the reasons for that is they ought to view evangelical students unfavorably because we go to college without knowing why we believe what we believe. And then these college professors question young people on why they believe what they believe, and the kids can't answer.
Yeah, I went to Queens College, majored in Hebrew for my undergrad work before going to New York University. I was talking to a woman who had her PhD in education and was a professor at Queens College, committed Christian, and she said she was shocked at her first faculty meeting when some of the profs were talking about how many students they got. She's, what do you mean? Oh, got to leave their faith.
Mm-hmm.
Mocking the faith and pulling people out of these superstitious old beliefs.
Right.
So you go on the campuses. Mm-hmm. Give me a list of the biggest issues that you have to combat and deal with that these kids are bombarded by.
Well, typically what I do is I present four basic points on college campus. The first point is, does truth exist? Of course, the answer is yes, because if anyone ever says there is no truth, you ask them, is that true? So we deal with relativism or postmodernism first. Mm-hmm. Second question is, does God exist? And we give three arguments for the existence of God. One of them is what we were just talking about before the break, the cosmological argument, the argument for the beginning of the universe out of nothing. The third argument is, are miracles possible? Obviously, you can't have the Bible being true if miracles are not possible. So we point out that not only are miracles possible, the greatest miracle of all has already occurred. What's the greatest miracle of all? The creation of the universe out of nothing. And in fact, the greatest miracle in the Bible is not the resurrection. It's the first verse. If the first verse is true, every other verse is believable. So we point that out. Mm. We also argue against David Hume's argument against miracles, where he tried to say that miracles don't occur anymore. We refute that. The fourth question we deal with, and the question that shows that Christianity is true, after does truth exist, does God exist, or miracles possible, is the New Testament reliable? In other words, did miracles really occur in the first century that authenticated Jesus and the apostles as truly being from God? And of course, we give evidence that the answer is yes. If that's the case, the entire Bible's true. Why? because Jesus, who's in these documents, says that the entire Old Testament is the Word of God. And if he really is God, as the New Testament documents claim he is, then whatever he teaches is true. So if the New Testament's reliable, you get the Old Testament thrown in. So those 4 points, Mike, truth, God, miracles, and the New Testament, sum up the argument that we present, and I don't have enough faith to be an atheist. Now, the questions after we present that evidence are usually around those four topics. They try and punch holes in those four topics, and rarely do they have success because it's a pretty tight argument.
All right. Now, when I was debating Professor Bart Ehrman in April at Ohio State University.
Good debate, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
Yes.
It was a joy.
Yeah.
There were parents of a grad that were interviewed by some of our folks that were there circulating in the crowd getting feedback. And these parents said that their daughter came into school as a believer, as I understand the story, in school, devastated by the anti-God, anti-Christian beliefs, fell away from the faith. And they said if we had just had one debate like this that she could have come to, it could have saved her faith, because it's saying, here's someone else who's educated, who's intellectual, who's sane of mind, who has good arguments. Sometimes that's all they need.
Yes.
Is just to see there's someone who is a thinking human being, because there's that intimidation.
Yes.
College professor knows so much.
Right.
College, they quote all these languages. They know all these literature.
Right.
They're famous, and I'm just the student. And the professor's even a parental figure on some level, because the kids are away from home. They're mocking this. Nobody who has any brains believes these things. And then you come in, Frank, with brains, clear-headed presentation, loving the challenges, and from New Jersey too, so fast talking.
Yeah.
as a New Yorker, appreciate that. So do you see, first for the believing students, that you come in and it almost saves their faith? Like, thank God there are answers?
Well, we get emails and testimonies like that all the time. Yes, a lot of times you don't have to answer all their questions. You just have to show that Christianity is reasonable, because the bar is set so low by the college professors. They mock Christianity to such a degree that if you come on a college campus and just give a few reasonable answers, they're going, wow, this is amazing. I didn't know there were answers out there. And of course, you provide them with the book, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, which argues from the ground up that Christianity is indeed true. So it's important. Now, you mentioned Bart Ehrman, who you debated. Bart Ehrman is one of the folks out there that is deliberately trying to remove kids from their Christian faith. And he will admit that. He thinks that it's silly to believe in Christianity. But that's why it was so great that you debated him. But the problem with Ehrman is when people go to, say, UNC Chapel Hill and listen to him, they go, am I going to listen to my pastor or this professor who my parents are paying several thousand dollars to send me to hear? My pastor never told me any of this stuff.
And my pastor, if he knows Greek, he only knows a little. Professor Ehrman knows more than that in his sleep.
Right.
But so it's intimidating.
It is intimidating. And so a lot of kids side with the pastor. Now, here's the other element to this, Mike. As you know, when you go to college campus, you almost have a moral reason not to believe in God. Why? Because you want to go do your own thing. You don't want to do what your parents told you to do or your pastor told you to do. You want to experiment. You see the opposite sex. You want to do all these
things. Same sex.
Or the same sex now. Right. Yeah. You want to rebel a little bit. So there's a lot of elements that are conspiring against students when they go to college. So here's quick advice. Get evidence before they go to college. In other words, inoculate them. Number two, get them with a Christian roommate or Christian group before they get to college. If you go to crossexamined.org and go to the resources and links section, you'll see a ministry there called the Youth Transition Network. They can connect you with a college Christian roommate before you get to college, or a college Christian group.
Tremendous. And the other thing, parents, make sure your kids are not just following in the family faith.
Yes.
They've really got to know the Lord personally. Someone once said, a man with an experience is never at the mercy of a man with an argument. So when you have kids, maybe they're church, but they're not really walking closely with the Lord. Now they get around other peers that are not believers, and their professors are not believers. It's a recipe for disaster. Crossexamined.org. Friends, it's summertime. Some of you have kids that are going to college this fall, secular universities. You need to go to that website and check out that link. We come back, we're gonna plunge a little bit deeper into some of the pressing questions of our day. Stay with us. joining us today, friends. Michael Brown with my special guest apologist, Dr. Frank Turek. We're devoting the entire show to this interview, so sit back, not taking calls, but you can email me at drbrown@askdrbrown.org. If you don't have any of Frank's materials, make sure you go to his website, crossexamined, that's E-D, crossexamined.org. Get his book, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. Watch his debates with Christopher Hitchens. Find out about the links they have that help you if your kids are going to college to hook up with other believers or with other Christian groups on campus. Frank, we were talking during the break about the moral argument is one of the strongest arguments that we can bring. You know, the atheists really challenge this and claim that there can be morality without God. And I don't know that they would say there can be absolute morals, but first tell us how this argument works, and then let me challenge it a little bit and give me some responses.
Yeah, the argument goes like this. Basically, that there is an objective moral law out there, and if that's the case, then God exists. Because if there is no God, then all moral opinions are just that. They're just opinions. If there is no God, you can't say Mother Teresa was any better than Hitler in any objective sense. Why? Because it's just your opinion against Hitler's opinion. It's just Mother Teresa's opinion against Hitler's opinion. If there's not a standard that is beyond humanity, then it's just two human beings arguing over a particular act. There can be no such thing in an objective sense. In other words, it's outside of us. It's independent of what we think about it. It just exists, this moral standard. Even if the Nazis had won World War II, Mike, and had convinced everybody that murdering Jews was okay, murdering Jews would still be wrong. In other words, it's not just a matter of human opinion. There's a standard, an unchangeable standard beyond humanity, which says certain things are objectively right and certain things are objectively wrong. Christians, of course, believe that's God's very nature. If there's no God, then the Holocaust was just a matter of opinion.
All right. So let's look at it from an evolutionary point of view. Mm-hmm. We are the most advanced of the species, and our brains have developed in certain ways that have produced things that the animal kingdom doesn't have. And there are certain things that, for the good of society, we have agreed on are, quote, right or wrong.
Okay, before we go on, let me just say this, because I always stop people when they ask questions. I know you're playing devil's advocate here, but you just said for the good of society. Now, good is begging the question.
Okay,
what do you mean
survival.
By good?
For our ongoing survival. Survival of the fittest.
Okay, why is it good to survive, and why is it moral to survive?
Well, it's not moral to survive.
Okay, well, then we don't have a moral law then, do we?
It's positive to survive because that's just our instinct. Everything wants to survive. So a lion kills a zebra because it wants to survive. The zebra runs from the lion because it wants to survive.
Right.
Okay. So,
but when a lion goes after a zebra, it's not murder.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. So, but we have developed on a higher level than the animals. We are in a higher plane just by the luck of evolution, by random chance and survival of the fittest.
Okay.
And we know that we have to protect each other if we're going to make it, that there has to be some type of group or clan of mentality.
No, we don't.
Well, sure.
No, we don't.
Sure we have to.
Because Castro didn't have to protect everybody. Castro killed. He still kills people down there in Cuba. And he's surviving just fine. His DNA will survive. What does he care about other people's DNA?
Well, just universally, though, we've worked out principles, which is I don't want to do something to you that I don't want done to me. So just for my own good, if I'm married, I don't want someone to mess with my wife. So therefore, just trying to be pragmatic, I won't mess with someone else's wife, so it won't come back on me.
But if you can mess with somebody else's wife and get away from it from an atheistic perspective, why wouldn't you?
Well, because here's the thing. Ultimately, our brains have developed, and we have signals in our brains that tell us things are moral. There's no absolute morality. It's just the way our brains have developed.
Okay, good. All right, let's take that then. This is a difference that philosophers call the difference between epistemology and ontology. Now, very simply, epistemology means how we know something. And ontology talks about the essence of a thing or that something exists. I might know morality because my parents taught it to me or society taught it to me, but that it's wrong to murder exists independently of me or society. In fact, let me use an analogy from mathematics. I learned the times tables from my fourth grade teacher, Mr. Fisher. That's epistemology. That's how I came to know the times tables. But the fact that 4 times 4 equals 16 existed independently of me or Mr. Fisher. That's ontology. Now, what the evolutionists are doing is they're confusing epistemology with ontology. They're trying to say we know morality by evolution or natural selection, whatever they come up with. Okay, that might be true. I don't think it is, but even let's grant them that. That doesn't explain why murder is wrong. Why is murder wrong? Why can't Hitler come along and say, I'm going to murder as many people as I want, and there's nothing wrong with that?
Right. In his mind, that was the best species.
Right.
And you have to weed out all the other subspecies.
Right.
And the supremacy of the Aryan super being.
Mm-hmm.
So winning or losing doesn't prove morality.
No. If it did, then it would be whoever has the most might at the barrel of a gun wins.
Right. Well, one point that, and I tried to be the devil's advocate.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a little hard here.
I know.
Actually,
you're doing a good job, though.
But when I debated Bart Ehrman, I made the point that if there's no God, there's no problem of suffering.
Sure.
When a lion kills a zebra, or a spider kills a fly, or maybe a child predator kills a child, that's why is there a problem?
Right.
Why is there a moral problem unless there's a God?
Right.
So even challenging this and raising an issue is somewhat self-defeating.
Yes.
And, you know, who says that might doesn't make right?
Right. Well, Lewis in Mere Christianity, who we quote extensively, and I don't have enough faith to be an atheist, put it this way. He said, as an atheist, my argument against gods was that the world seems so cruel and unjust. But how had I gotten this idea of just and unjust? A man does not call a line crooked unless he has some idea of what a straight line was.
Yeah.
What was I comparing this universe with when I called it unjust? In other words, you don't know injustice unless you know justice, and you don't know justice unless there's a standard beyond yourself, namely God. So evil doesn't disprove God. It actually is a backhanded way of showing there's a God, because you wouldn't know evil unless you knew good. Just like, as you said to Ehrman, suffering has no meaning if there's no God.
And there's no possible redemption.
Right,
there's
right.
no possible other side or goal that can come out of it. Yeah, and that's the thing that I find interesting. And maybe we can talk about this briefly when we come back.
Mm-hmm.
I know it's not universal, but it's very common to see that atheists had either father issues or some other things in their upbringing. Again, not universal, but it's striking. Or Madeleine Murray O'Hare and her hatred for her father. Or someone at an early age loses their father and then goes through a faith crisis after that. Have you seen that pattern?
Yeah, but, in fact, Paul Vitz did a study of that from NYU a number of years ago.
Yes.
Yes, Faith of the Fatherless, I think he called it.
And another one wrote a book called The Atheist Syndrome.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, it's fascinating to read these. And even though the person may have intellectually come to their conclusions and firmly held to them, we're still emotional beings as well. But again, I think it's just important to press this. When people talk about the problem of evil or the problem of suffering, it's only a problem if there's a God and we are not just a higher evolved species. Okay, friends, askdrbrown.org. Click on The Line of Fire. We've got a link to Frank Turek's website and to some of his books. I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, best-selling book, wonderful, clear, compelling. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Back, friends, to The Line of Fire broadcast. Michael Brown with my friend and colleague, Dr. Frank Turek, a top apologist, busy on college campuses, busy on radio and television as well. Frank, how often are you now speaking on college campuses?
Do between 10 and 12 events a semester. By the way, if anyone out there wants a college event, go to our website, crossexamine.org, and email me, and we'll see about coming to your college. I've been to probably 50 in the past 2 years.
Really?
Yeah, doing a lot of college events, and they're usually well attended, because anytime you title something, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, Mike, you get everybody from atheist to Christian and everyone in between showing up. So there's a time for presentation and usually a very lively time of Q&A as well.
And I've seen some where you got people sitting on the floor and the place is just packed out. Do you find with the rise of The New Atheist, 2007, was called The Year of the Atheist, best-selling books and so on. Do you find that the questions from students are getting more sophisticated?
You know, you get the same questions over and over again, actually. It depends on what I'm presenting. I break up the presentation into two parts, truth and God in the first presentation and then miracles in the New Testament in the second. But they're basically the same questions you get all the time. You get a lot of questions on age of the earth. You get questions on string theory. You get questions on the multi-universe theory, which we talked about earlier. When you get into miracles, a lot of times you get questions on do miracles occur today? Sometimes you get questions when you're in the New Testament on, pagan origins of the New Testament. Did they come from pagan origins or not? But the presentation is pretty tight, I mean, logically. And so a lot of times you get kind of oblique attacks on the evidence. You don't really get a head-on attack because it's pretty solid stuff.
So they're used to mocking and attacking, yes. Not necessarily intellectually thinking through the issues.
Yeah, they don't. You know, it was interesting. I had in Davidson College, which is right here near Charlotte, last March, I had a situation during Q&A where a young lady was asking question after question, skeptical question after skeptical question, and I'd respond to them, and it was like she wasn't even listening to the
right
response. And I finally stopped, and I said, can I ask you a question? Will you give me an honest answer? She said, sure, go ahead. I said, if Christianity were true, would you become a Christian? And immediately she said, no. And I said, well, why are we even doing this then? Why don't we just go have pizza? Because it's not a matter of the mind for you. It's a matter of the will. You don't want Christianity to be true, you see?
I had debated a rabbi friend in New York City one time, and it was one of the more heated ones where people were surrounding me afterwards, some of the Jewish community in New York yelling at me and just upset, and how could I say this and that? And one woman came up and asked me a question, and the moment I began to answer, and if she asked me, I began to respond, and she began to shake her head. No, no. And I said, wait, stop. I hadn't even said anything yet. My name is Michael. I hadn't said anything. And I said, look, if you're not going to listen, what's the point of our interacting? If you're not going to listen, why are we even talking?
That's but part of the problem.
At least I got I don't think the mind was thinking differently, but I got the head to stop moving for a little while.
They don't want it to be true. In fact, with Christopher Hitchens, and you might pray for Christopher, he has cancer, we've just learned. At the end of his book, he basically says, I will not live under this divine tyranny. What's the divine tyranny? God.
Yes.
And so I summed up his book in both debates, and my last statement was, you can sum up Christopher Hitchens' book in one sentence. This is it. There is no God, and I hate him.
Exactly.
And I say that in a way not to be disrespectful to Christopher, but his whole tone and his entire argument is basically he doesn't like God. He doesn't even deal really with the evidence that God doesn't exist or deal with the arguments that we give that God does exist. He deflects those and just rants about how religious people have done evil things and God is a problem.
Right, and how horrible the God of the Bible
right
would be. And I think we have to be sensitive to the issues. And in other words, as a non-believer reading the scriptures, you're not going to give this God the benefit of the doubt.
Mm-hmm.
And he could seem like a cruel tyrant and
sure
just capricious murderer or jealous or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I once told one fellow, I said, you know, look, you go in a room, there's someone being held down, and another guy's got a knife and is cutting him open. I said, is he a murderer or a surgeon?
Mm.
You don't know. Just based on that outward appearance.
Right.
You know, we were spanked as kids by our fathers, you know, in a good reasoned way when we crossed certain lines. It wasn't child abuse.
It's because he loved us.
Right. Exactly. So Nancy and I listened to the Hitchens-Craig debate, and then we've listened to your debates with Christopher Hitchens. And a theme he hits on over and over, and I'm looking at the clock. We'll have to take this up on the other side of the break. It's the theme of freedom and liberation. And I thought, you know, if I ever get to debate him, of course, we pray for healing and health for him and for real revelation of the love of God. I would really want to start out and emphasize the whole thing, the incredible liberating power of the gospel. And I love to take the very argument someone's going to bring and turn it against. Look, Jesus said that it's the truth that sets us free. Stay with us. We'll be back.
Fire we want.
You know, Pilate asked Jesus, what is truth? Another question we can ask, what is freedom? Michael Brown here with my friend and colleague, apologist Dr. Frank Turek. We've been talking about the theme of many of his presentations on college campuses, I don't have enough faith to be an atheist. And before the break, we were talking about a theme of atheist Christopher Hitchens, again, with cancer now, so we're praying for God's mercy and grace to flood his life. But he wants everyone to be liberated, be liberated from the tyranny of religion, be liberated from the tyranny of this God who, if you do wrong, he'll kill you. You can't even think and make moral choices for yourself. You just live by his commands and this binding tyranny. You as a believer, a follower of Jesus, have you found faith to be liberating?
Oh, of course it's liberating. And let's point out a couple other things. Number one, there is no such thing as freedom if atheism is true, because we're just molecules in motion if atheism is true. So this idea of freedom that Christopher's talking about can't exist in an atheistic worldview. There's no such thing as reason either, because we're just molecules in motion. We're not free beings. We're just dancing to our DNA, I think, as Dawkins once said. So he's borrowing from the Christian worldview in order to argue against it, Michael. He's borrowing freedom. He's borrowing reason. He's borrowing these things in order to argue against it. Secondly, freedom is a moral concept. Why is more freedom good? Why is the freedom of religion, the freedom of speech, all these things good if there is no God? There is no such thing as morality if there is no God, not in an objective sense anyway.
So freedom is a concept shot through with morality.
Yes.
Rather, think of civil rights movement. Think of apartheid in South Africa. Think of just slavery in general, sex trafficking, human trafficking. We're all horrified over it, and it's for moral purposes. And it's different than chicken in a chicken coop. We're talking about a human being, so there's something qualitatively different we recognize. I have no problem, if there is a God that created everything, to say I'm going to bow down before him, because that right off is telling me that I'm not so big and that he is. If the universe is as vast as we understand it to be and greater than we can possibly conceive with our human brains, the creator of that is worthy of my awe and reverence, especially if he is loving and good. But it's not just a matter of servitude. It's a matter of servitude that's liberating.
That's right. And the number one rule in life is there is a God and you are not him. Okay,
right.
So we need to get that in place. But secondly, it is liberating because we were created to worship God. And quickly, what we need to keep in mind, too, is God doesn't get anything out of us worshiping him or cursing him. He's an infinite being. He can't be improved. He can't be degraded. It's for our benefit that we worship God. It's for our benefit that we acknowledge him. It's not for God's benefit. It's for our benefit that we obey moral rules. It keeps us safe.
So if in the same way that we educate people in the arts or classical music or literature to expand who they are, to expand their knowledge, or travel to different countries, knowing who God is expands us massively.
Oh, absolutely. It's the greatest question in the history of thought. That's why Mortimer Adler, who wrote the Great Book series, was asked, why is the God section so big in your series? It's the largest. He said, because more implications flow from the question, does God exist, than any other.
And Frank, we are out of time. I appreciate you being with me. Frank's got a weekly radio show on American Family Radio Network. Many of you hear our shows on Sunday. He's on Saturdays. He's got a TV show, apologetic TV show, and a great website, crossexamined.org. Truly, God made us for purpose. When we come to know him, we discover our purpose. That's the most liberating thing possible. Frank, I appreciate your time.
Thanks, Michael, and appreciate your show and all you do.
Hey, we're going for it, man. So visit the website, askdrbrown.org. Click on the line of fire. We've got links to Frank's material and to his website, crossexamined.org. And friend, be strong in the truth. We have every reason to believe.